Becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you to earn more and save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates.
Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you can start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Navy Federal also offers equity loan options to help you get the funds you need to consolidate high interest debt, work on home improvements, or cover any of life's big expenses.
To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, their members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender, membership required. Terms and conditions apply, loan subject to approval. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking future-proofing your career and crypto advice for noobs with Kevin Roos.
Yeah, so with topics like cryptocurrency and artificial intelligence, you can expect that we're going to be talking with someone who's extremely well-versed with technology, and that is exactly who we have joining us today. Kevin Roos is an award-winning tech columnist for the New York Times and the New York Times bestselling author of three books, Future Proof, Young Money, and The Unlikely Disciple. He's the host of the Rabbit Hole podcast, and he writes and speaks regularly on all topics related to our modern age, including automation and AI, social media, talks about cybersecurity, digital wellness. But today we are going to attempt to narrow his focus to discussing some of the different ways that we can ensure that your career can continue to grow with the rise of AI. In addition to we're going to do a little deep dive into cryptocurrencies and how you should be thinking about them today. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today on How to Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kevin, we're glad to have you. And first question we ask anybody who comes on the show is, what's your craft beer equivalent? Matt and I, we love craft beer. We spend more money than most people think is wise on good beer while we're also saving and investing intentionally for the future. So yeah, what's that for you? What do you like to splurge on?
Well, I thought of two things, one of which is sort of an early pandemic splurge, and one of which is a more recent one. But my early pandemic splurge, I bought myself a fancy gaming PC. Oh. And like, I am not like a fancy computer guy. Like, I'm sort of like a whatever gets the job done guy. But early in the pandemic, I was like, if I'm going to be working from home, if I'm going to be, you know, playing video games to pass the time,
if I'm
going to
be playing games while I'm also working working. I've got to get two separate devices.
Exactly. So I got like the stupidest, biggest gaming computer I could find. And it's like one of these ones that has like, you know, rainbow colored, like neon lights coming out. It looks like a freaking space machine. And it's so dumb. And I love it. And I'm obsessed with it. And I tell all my friends, like, buy the biggest, dumbest gaming PC you can. So that was my early pandemic exposure. My more recent one is beach gear. So I am like, I'm not like a total, like, I don't, you know, I live in Northern California. Sometimes it's, you know, cold here. But when I do go to the beach, I've decided that, like, I want to be one of those dads who has like three wagons full of gear like trailing behind him. Oh. And so I've just been accumulating this like completely absurd, like, my spouse thinks I'm insane, but I've got like a beach hammock, I've got like, you know, all the flotation devices you could want. I spent like $40 on like an infant little like floaty thingy for like my kid the other day. Like, it's just, it's getting out of control, and it's getting to the point where like multiple trips are necessary to like carry all the gear every time we go to the beach. So I think I need to stop, but that has been my splurge.
You also need to hire a beach Sherpa to help you transport everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, for listeners, we mentioned before we hit record, you are a new father. And so congrats on that. But I think a lot of times, some of these early months, some of those early years of having that first kid, you want to be prepared. You want to have the gear. But I feel like with four kids, I've reached the point to where I'm like, hey, if you can't carry it, I'm not taking it to the beach.
Exactly. This might be a one kid privilege showing where I'm like, I can just carry all this stuff myself.
That's true. Well, actually, you know, as a tech writer, like, what are your favorite pieces of technology that you use regularly that maybe most of us probably don't even know about, whether that's actual hardware? That's kind of what we're talking about with you going to the beach, or even different software, or maybe, yeah, just some like kind of oddballs, maybe subscriptions or something like that. But yeah, I'm curious if there are, as someone who is more versed and more steeped in this arena, are there some pieces of tech that you use that we don't even know about?
Well, I try to try most things once just for my job. So like, I've got all the sleep rings and wearables and household robots and stuff like that. So I've got like a house full of gadgets. The one that's been bringing me joy recently is I just upgraded my Roomba. I had one of the earliest Roombas, probably 10 years old at this point. And it just sucked. It wasn't, you know, it was making the floor dirtier every time I vacuum.
And just broadcasted and so all the dirt.
Bad robot.
I got one of the new ones, and I did not appreciate like how much Roomba technology has improved in the past like 5 or 10 years. It now like texts me. First of all, it has a name, so its name is Bruce, so Bruce Roos, and I get these texts when we're like, you know, out at the store or something like that, that will say, Bruce is stuck and needs your help. And I sort of like have a bond with it now that I didn't have before when it didn't have a name and it was just this like non-sentient thing that was vacuuming my floors. So that's my latest gadget.
It's newest gadget and newest friend. I like that.
Well, you need to have the Roomba to sweep up all that beach sand. What model do you have? Because this is something that my wife and I have been talking about.
Oh, God. It's like whatever the newest one is that was recommended on the Wirecutter.
Okay. All right. I'll
look it up. I'll link to it because that is something, again, with four kids, I'm just like, you know, if we can just have a daily sweep on the lower floor, just where we're living, where most of the mess is going down, I think that would, yeah, it would.
Yeah, I have two dogs, so it's like, my Roomba wants to commit suicide. It's like, it's just, it's overworked.
Nice.
And underpaid. Well, let's talk about, we want to talk about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general in later on in this podcast. But I want to talk about artificial intelligence before we dig too much into that, because, you know, so many folks are bullish on how artificial intelligence is going to impact our society. But you've actually called yourself a sub-optimist when it comes to the future of artificial intelligence technology and how it's going to impact our collective future as a whole. So I don't know. I'm curious, why is it that you're kind of down on AI? And yeah, what are your thoughts on kind of where things are headed?
Well, I would say sub-optimist is the word that I came up with, because I wasn't comfortable with sort of pessimism as a default stance toward AI. I think that a lot of people are just like, you know, especially in the media and in over the years have been sort of just poo-pooing AI in general. And I don't, that doesn't really resonate with me. Like, I don't think that all AI is bad, but I don't think that all AI is necessarily good either, which I think puts me in something of an awkward middle position. So suboptimism is just the word that I came up with to sort of try to capture the feeling of like, I'm kind of optimistic about the technology, but I'm less optimistic about how the technology is going to be implemented and deployed. So I think this is important to separate because we see these advances in AI and conversational AI and, you know, protein folding and all the things that are coming out of the big tech companies now that are on their own pretty cool. And then we see what happens when that technology is deployed in workplaces, in communities, in families, and it's often much less good. And so, you know, I'm thinking a lot these days about workplace AI. You know, there's been this idea for just decades and decades that AI was going to take away the parts of our jobs that we hated anyway. You know, it was going to do all of our mundane drudge work for us and, you know, take care of all our expense reports and all the boring stuff that we do on a daily basis. And so it would leave us with the most fascinating, interesting human parts. And that's a great idea, and I would love if that happened. But what we've actually seen as AI has been deployed in workplaces is that it's often taking away the parts of people's jobs that they enjoy, the parts that are spontaneous, that are human, that involve, you know, communicating with other people. And so I think about something like an Amazon warehouse where you have essentially AI as the manager now. I mean, the employees that are tracked within an inch of their life, some of them wear bracelets that, you know, vibrate when they're not meeting their packing targets. Like, it's an atmosphere of AI management. And as a result, it has basically turned the humans there into robots. They are punished when they deviate from the tasks that the machine has set out for them. And so I think that's a really dystopian idea.
Yeah.
This idea that instead of freeing us from drudgery, AI in the workplace might actually be creating more drudgery, might be turning us into robots rather than freeing us up to become more human.
Yeah, not to mention that it doesn't necessarily perfectly optimize the amount of time that we're spending, even outside of work, right? Because you see what algorithms and technology has done when it comes to what we're being fed within our feeds.
Sucking our attention up.
And we fall more into that sort of WALL-E sort of scape, and we're all sitting there not truly living our lives and floating around being fed what we think we want to be fed. But yeah, I mean, you also say that artificial intelligence that is coming for white-collar jobs as well. It's not necessarily just robots and conveyance, you know, within the warehouses. It's not just entry-level jobs. And so what types of jobs do you see AI coming for, like, right now, as well as maybe a little bit further off, maybe in the near future?
Well, right now, AI is sort of a broad term that encompasses lots of different things. There's, like, you know, hardware robotics that are being implemented in factories and warehouses, like the Amazon warehouse that you mentioned. There's also software automation. There's a whole category of software bot called RPA, which stands for robotic process automation, and is maybe the most boring thing that is actually important. But it is basically this trend within white collar workplaces where middle office employees, people who do, you know, accounts payable and you know, HR tasks and expense approval and things like that, those are all being automated away. And there's actually been some fascinating research from Stanford and the Brookings Institution that sort of showed that the jobs most likely to be impacted by the sort of current wave of software automation are actually not the sort of blue collar and retail jobs. They are the kind of middle management jobs at some of these high tech, high skill, highly paid white collar workplaces. And so that's a trend that I'm keeping tabs on. I think the most recent thing that I've been tracking is the use of AI for jobs that we would have considered creative, that we would have maybe even predicted were impossible to automate. So I've been playing around with and looking at other people playing around with this new AI model called DALL-E 2. Have you heard of this?
No.
So this is something that came out from the AI company OpenAI just this year. It's brand new. And it basically is this, if you've seen on Twitter or on social media, people posting these like auto-generated images that say like, you know, I asked an AI to draw me, you know, a picture of six grizzly bears playing tennis on the moon. And it will spit out, you know, several different versions of that. Or you can say, you know, I want to see, you know, Vladimir Putin riding on a dolphin, and it will generate that. And it's actually quite good.
Wow.
And so, you know, there are now many AIs that are doing this kind of thing at a level that I think is pretty on par with the best human illustrators, and much, much faster and cheaper, obviously, than hiring someone to draw you a picture of Vladimir Putin riding on a dolphin.
That's interesting.
And so I think that's the kind of job, illustrator or, you know, digital artist, that we might have assumed was safe from automation, that it turns out is not at all.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is interesting, because you're right. Those are kind of maybe some of the last jobs, those most creative ones that I would have said, yeah, would be last on the chopping block. But the fact that those are potentially ripe for the picking is a little scary. And
If it's got digital in front of whatever the traditional job was. So like, oh, artist. Oh, yeah, you're fine. I'm a digital artist. Oh, actually.
Actually, you're gone. If you don't paint on physical canvas.
It's like I'm an accountant. Oh, yeah, I focus on digital account. Oh, yeah, maybe not.
Yeah. Well, so when it comes to fears about technology replacing humans, those have been around for decades, if not centuries.
Millennia, so, actually.
Yeah. Millennia? Okay. Well, yeah, talk to us a little about that. And then maybe, like, you know, there's always, when these transitions happen, there's always acute pain in certain specific sectors for a specific range of time. But it always seems like that disruption leads to new jobs in other areas. And so, yeah, I don't know. Are the fears today of AI replacing these jobs, like when you just said that, that made me like a little bit scared. Like, are those fears right, or are they misplaced? Are we just like, is the disruption that happens going to eventually end up creating more better things and more better work for people?
As long as we don't call ourselves digital podcasters, yeah. I think we're going to be okay.
Right.
Exactly. I think trying to predict which jobs will and won't disappear is like a fool's game. We have, you know, centuries of predictions that have turned out to be accurate in some ways and inaccurate in other ways. So if I knew exactly which jobs were going to disappear, I would be an oracle. But I do think there are a couple things we can say. One is the research appears to indicate that today's job losses due to automation are different than job losses of past technological eras. In every technological wave, there's new technology that comes in, wipes out some of the jobs, but creates other jobs. So in the Industrial Revolution, you know, you had factories that and you know, automated farming equipment that took away some of the labor that was needed to run a farm or produce textiles or other things like that. So that eliminated some jobs, but it created many, many more jobs in these urban factories. And so we could just extrapolate from that and say, well, you know, yeah, there will be illustrators and accountants and, you know, maybe podcasters and writers who lose their jobs during this wave, but there will be many, many more jobs created. But there's been some interesting research that sort of pokes holes in that narrative. In particular, there was a paper by these two economists, Acemoglu and Restrepo, a couple years ago, that introduced the concept of what they call so-so automation, which is automation, that the kind of automation that is just barely better than a human at a task. So it's better than a human by, you know, a couple percentage points, which is good enough to eliminate that job and to create the economics to incentivize eliminating that job, but is not good enough to create new categories of jobs. So an example of this might be, for example, like the the automated customer service receptionist. I'm sure we've all had the frustrating experience of like calling in to get, you know, customer service with something. You get the robot on the other end, and you know, if you're me, at least you're pushing zero. Like, you're like, I want to get to a human. This yep. robot sucks. It's slow. It can't, doesn't know what I'm talking about. But it's good enough that the companies that implement these things feel justified in doing that and eliminating some of their customer service staff that way. The problem is, it's actually not that good. It's not good enough where you could take out the whole call center. You still have to have people there for those press zero sticklers like me. And so you end up with this technology that is not creating great leaps forward in productivity or output or capability. All it's doing is just shaving down the cost of running a call center a little bit, which is the kind of technology they argue in this paper on social automation that destroys more jobs than it creates.
Is this the kind of thing, though, where it's happening in such a way that it's not light years ahead of kind of where things currently stand and the current human-based systems, where it buys us some time? It buys time for people to pursue other avenues, to get retrained in another job, where if the AI was progressing at such a rate where it was like, boom, this human, obsolete. It would maybe make for a more rapid, more frightening transition, but maybe it's not going to be quite like that.
Yeah, it won't be quite like that. I mean, there's this sort of fiction that, you know, the way automation takes your job is that you just show up one day and there's like a robot sitting in your seat. And it's like, sorry, Joe, you know, your services are no longer necessary because we've got Joe Robot here. And that doesn't really happen that way. And it basically never did. I think what's hard about sort of the buying more time thesis is that I don't think a lot of people are actually aware that their jobs are in the slow process of being automated until they're actually fired, until they're automated. You know, in previous waves of technology, like in the middle of the 20th century, there were a lot of factories, for example, car factories or heavy machinery processing plants that were implementing robots. But like everyone knew when the robot was on the job, because there was a big freaking machine that got wheeled into the factory one day and it was right there on the assembly line, and you could see as a worker which parts
tangible.
Of the job it was doing. And so you could kind of assess your own risk. Just you would say, oh, that robot looks like it's pretty good at welding. I'm a welder. I better look for something else to do. But now, like, it's all software. It's mostly software. And so the way that it's being implemented is much less visible. It's like one day a consultant comes in with an IT team and, you know, installs three different apps that each do 20% of a person's job. And so those people aren't even necessarily aware that that's happening. It's just all of a sudden their department shrinks, there's layoffs, or, you know, jobs go unfilled, and their jobs are eliminated even if they don't really grasp that that's what's happening.
Okay, let's talk about how we can make ourselves less replaceable. In your book, Future Proof, you talk about like resisting machine drift. You talk about demoting our devices. Can you explain a little bit to listeners what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think there's been this idea that's been pretty, you know, sort of popular and widespread over the past several decades in sort of American society and education, that the way to be competitive in this digital future is to kind of turn yourself into a machine, is to be super productive, to work all the time, to probably major in like a STEM field, to get really good at programming, to, like, you know, basically get on the side of the machine. Like that is how we
endear yourself to the computers now.
Exactly. Like make yourself as close to a machine as humanly possible, and that's the way to get ahead. And that was sort of my idea when I started writing this book, and I went out to all these AI researchers and technologists, and I asked them, like, what can humans do to protect ourselves? What can we do to make sure that we are not becoming obsolete? And what they said was fascinating, because it was basically the exact opposite of what I had expected. Instead of saying, like, go, you know, study engineering or go to coding boot camp or, you know, work 20 hours a day, like, what they said was that we need to figure out what our advantages are. We need to tack away from the machines, because the things that they do, they will do better than us and cheaper than us and faster than us. And so we need to spend our time figuring out what we can do that they can't do and that they're not likely to be able to do for many, many years, and to focus our energy on improving our performance in those areas. So in the book, I talk about three areas in particular where humans have an advantage over even the best AI today. I call them surprising, social, and scarce. And so those are the kinds of labor, those like surprising jobs that are irregular, that don't have a lot of repetition and pattern to them, that involve sort of meeting people's social needs rather than material needs, and that are involve sort of rare, scarce combinations of skills, abilities, the things that you know machines will not be taught to do for a long time. And so those are the areas where I think we need to focus our energy on rather than trying to, you know, one-up the machines.
You've talked about how your accountant is a former comedian, right? And how he kind of sets himself apart in a way that most accountants aren't able to, and how maybe that's going to prolong his job security.
Exactly. What I did when I was researching the book was I looked for industries that were heavily, affected by automation, and I looked at the survivors in those industries. What have the people who are still working as travel agents today doing differently that has allowed them to persist in that field? What are the people who are doing things like tax accounting, which is highly, highly automated at this point? It's one of the most automated job fields in the world. What have the people who have built successful accounting businesses done differently? And I looked at, first at my own accountant, who's this amazing guy named Russ Garofalo, who has a firm called Brass Taxes, and he hires former comedians. He is himself a former comedian, and he pays for all his employees to get improv lessons. And at first I was like, what the heck does that have to do with doing taxes?
But I don't want to pay for that.
Right, exactly. But it turns out that it actually is the difference between him being able to be replaced by TurboTax or H&R Block or one of these other firms and not, because what he's doing is he's turning a function into an experience. He is turning the act of preparing your taxes from something that is mind-numbing and boring and dull into something that is entertaining and enjoyable and personable. And he's doing that at scale. And so I think there's a lesson in there for all of us, which is that even in parts of our jobs that are prone to being automated, what we can do as a kind of bulwark against that is to radically up the amount of humanity that we are bringing to that job.
Exactly. Yeah. Injecting that humanity, that soul. I mean, basically doing the exact opposite of what you were saying earlier, right? Where you've got factory or warehouse workers. And if you subscribe to the AI management overlord model, you are going to be treated like a robot, and eventually maybe you will be able to be replaced. But if you can find ways to inject that humanity into all things that you do, I think you're always going to have a secure career.
I think the same thing is true with podcasting, right? It's one of those things where, can you get some of this information that you're getting on a podcast you're listening to elsewhere?
Absolutely.
Yeah, in many cases, yes. But how is the information delivered is a huge part of how people feel about it, how they respond to it, and whether or not they want to keep listening. Kevin, we've got more questions we want to get to with you. We want to kind of transition into talking about cryptocurrency and maybe how our How to Money listeners should think about that. We'll get to some questions on that right after this. Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus 5-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in 5 delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/howtomoney.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. And now a word from the show sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Joel, longer days and warmer weather, it means our family is spending a lot more time outside. It's great. Like, literally yesterday, I was in the front yard, Kate was in the garden, and I was kicking the soccer ball around with a couple of the kids. I'm loving it. But something else that you can do for your family this spring, shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius as part of your financial planning for the year. Kate and I both have policies in place, and that means we have peace of mind so that if something were to happen to either of us, our family can cover expenses while getting back on our feet.
Yeah, with Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, by the way, it may not have enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. On top of that, Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies. That means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
That's right. So save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. All right, we are back. We're talking with Kevin Roos. We just talked a good bit about artificial intelligence, how we can secure our positions in the future. We're going to talk now about cryptocurrency. And Kevin, you know, you wrote an article, it wasn't even an article. It's almost like this, like
extensive
a guide.
Yeah.
I mean, it was actually called that, the Latecomer's Guide to Crypto. You wrote that in the Times. And, you know, like it felt like the Super Bowl, the tens of millions of dollars in ad spending by all the different crypto companies. It felt like that was the top of the crypto madness that we experienced earlier this year. Has your opinion about the future of cryptocurrency, has that changed since the beginning of the year and since you wrote that piece?
It certainly accelerated some things that I thought might happen. I mean, I am, as I say in the piece, like I'm a crypto moderate. Like I think there's a lot of scams and speculation, and it is not a place where, you know, I would recommend people invest like huge portions of their net worths. And I don't think the most skeptical take, which is that it's all crazy, it's all gambling and speculation, and there's nothing interesting or novel from a technological perspective happening here. I also don't buy that perspective totally. So right. I think I'm sort of in a lonely middle there. It is a very polarizing issue. Obviously, we're seeing like just a huge collapse in the prices of major cryptocurrencies. We've got, you know, exchanges that are in trouble. We've got some, you know, liquidity problems in the system. So it's clear that there's a crash happening now. You know, I think that's something that has happened before in crypto, unfortunately. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, like, you know, the first Bitcoin boom and then bust back in like 2013. And I think I wrote an article at the time saying like, Bitcoin is over. It's never coming back. It's dead. And, you know, fast forward, you know, I think Bitcoin was like $150 a piece at the time. And now it's wow. Even at its, you know, most crashed state, it's like still in the, you know, 20,000 range per Bitcoin. So we've had, you know, booms and busts in crypto. It's, you know, it's not good when it happens, obviously, but I think, you know, by now, you know, people know or should know that this is an incredibly volatile sector. And that, you know, if you're you know, betting money on crypto, it should be money that you're prepared to lose.
Yep, we completely agree with that take. And yeah, I love that you call yourself a crypto moderate. That's partly why we wanted to have you on, because it's really hard to find somebody who's kind of somewhere in between on crypto. Like, the takes are so extreme, and it's either it's either rat poison, it's a scam, or it's going to save the world and all of humanity from every single problem that exists. And so, like, why do you think opinions on cryptocurrency are so divisive?
Well, I think that a couple of things are happening here. One is I think crypto is essentially a religion. I and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. Like, I used to be a religion journalist. Like, you know, I have friends who are quite religious. Like, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
I think there is this element, though, that is present in many religions, though, where it's like, we don't speak ill of our people. Like, we don't,
right. Exactly.
We don't, yeah. You know, which is not true, by the way, in the stock market. So in the stock market, you know, there are short sellers, right? And there are short sellers who have a financial incentive to make certain prices go down. And that, I would argue, is actually a healthy part of the system, that because you have short sellers, you also have people doing research and trying to dig up frauds and expose them. And they can make a lot of money if something that they feel is overvalued actually turns out to be overvalued. And
they're injecting some honesty into the system.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's a kind of incentive for honesty, for investigation, for honestly reporting. And so I think in the stock market, you have this kind of self-regulating. Not self-regulating, because it's obviously, it is regulated. It needs that too. But you have this kind of segment of the market that is not just saying, like, everything's going to go up forever and that's great. Hmm. Whereas in crypto, right. Like, that is the feeling that a lot of people have or had until recently, is like, we're all in this together. We all make money together. We all lose money together. And so no one is going to blow the whistle on even the incredibly obvious frauds in the system. Mm-hmm. So I think to the extent that crypto is, you know, suffers from being a religion, it's that it, you know, it doesn't have a good sort of like self-cleaning function.
Yeah, it really, I mean, it's got its own language. It has its own priests, the different folks who investors or gamblers look to.
Matt Damon is basically the Pope, I think, at this point, right?
Okay, while we're talking about crypto, I mean, let's kind of talk about some of the fundamentals. Can you talk to us about the underlying technology and just kind of what makes blockchain so revolutionary? Can you explain that to folks?
Well, saying that it's revolutionary implies that I think it's like good, but I'll just do the sort of simple description here.
Sure, yeah.
So blockchains are a type of database at their, you know, most basic core. You can think about it a little bit like a Google spreadsheet, but without Google. So instead of having sort of one company or one person or one entity controlling what is put on the database, instead, you have this thing called a blockchain, which is basically a way for a network of computers all over the world owned by different people to coordinate and manage a shared database, and to do so in a way that is public, that is permanent, and that is very hard to hack or breach or tamper with in some way. So the Google spreadsheet without Google is sort of the most basic way to think about what a blockchain is. And then the next question is, well, what's going on to that database? And it can either be cryptocurrency transactions, that was the original use of blockchains, or it can be, you know, newer things like NFTs or smart contracts, and we can talk about all that stuff if you want to.
Yeah, so this technology, What are the best use case scenarios? Like, what are the ways in which you see it impacting our collective futures? Most in the most impactful ways.
Well, I think the thing that is most sort of compelling about the existence of blockchains is that they don't require trust in a centralized authority. For a lot of people, that's a big plus because they don't trust big banks, they don't trust the Federal Reserve, and some of that is pure ideology and politics, and some of it is, you know, people who, for example, people living under authoritarian regimes, who maybe don't feel like they can or actually aren't allowed to transact within the normal banking system.
Or even if you just used to be a Wells Fargo customer and you're like, dang, that was rough.
Exactly. And so I think that's where a lot of crypto proponents see hope for blockchains, is that you could be living, you know, as a dissident in a foreign regime somewhere that, you know, won't allow you to have a bank account, and yet this technology allows you to transact, to take part in, you know, global markets, to send money to your family, whatever it is you're doing, and that you don't need anyone's permission to do that.
So, I mean, you mentioned smart contracts. Is that one of the applications where you foresee it really taking off? Is it that? Is it the modern banking system that we have? Should we expect to see that on its way out? What are some of the specific ways that we can expect to see blockchain more in the future?
Well, I don't think banks are going anywhere. I think we'll have banks for a good long time, and there are lots of reasons for that. One of which is banks can actually get your money back if it's stolen. like there's some useful function there. I think most people are feel safer having their money in a bank than in a crypto wallet somewhere, as they should. So I also don't know that I think that crypto is necessarily going to be bigger in the future than it is today. I'm interested as a journalist in why people are using it today, what kind of development is taking place in it, and kind of the social and cultural aspects of it too. I mean, it is both true that that crypto is an incredibly sort of volatile asset, and that it has this amazing power to unite and inspire and radicalize, and like it is a cultural force as well as a technological one, and so I've been fascinated by that piece of it too, the kind of religious aspects of crypto, and honestly, like what happens when the prices collapse, as we're seeing right now. I mean, it's fascinating to watch people move through the stages of grief over over this, and more seriously, like I think it's very interesting to compare and contrast this with something like the global financial crisis in 2008, which did destroy a lot of people's faith in the banking system, in the government, in the Federal Reserve, and sort of created the conditions for a huge amount of political change. And I think there will be some similarities that come out of crypto, but of course it'll look totally different.
Do you think cryptocurrencies are ever going to be used as like a meaningful medium of exchange? Do you see a future where people buy milk and they pay for rent with like different crypto coins? Because, you know, right now that seems really hard to fathom. And that seemed like maybe one of the potential use case scenarios was the fact that, like, yeah, it's just this alternative to your U.S. dollars, to some sort of fiat currency. But with how volatile it is, and with the lack of, you know, not many people accepting cryptocurrency as payment anyway, it seems like one of those things that, I don't know, seems like a pie in the sky might never happen thing.
Yeah, I'm not particularly bullish on the case that crypto is going to be like people's daily spending money, just because, like, who is going to use Bitcoin to buy milk if the price of Bitcoin is, you know, going up or down 20% in a day? Like, that's just not going to happen.
It's just not going to happen, right? When there's that volatility,
exactly. And it's the transaction fees can be quite high on some of this stuff. The settlement time is not instantaneous on a lot of stuff. So in many ways, you know, you're better off paying for milk with cash or a credit card. I think where it gets interesting is in an environment where, you know, inflation is high, as we've seen. So the dollar is losing some of its purchasing power, you know, every month, every week. And where you have a little bit more sort of adoption of crypto. I think basically in order for crypto to become people's daily spending money, it would have to become totally abstracted from the end user. Because right now, like, trying to make a crypto payment is quite onerous, unless you're a nerd like me. It's not easy. And so I think if it's all, you know, if there were a version of, you know, Venmo or something where you could just like, you know, instead of sending $5 for milk, you could send $5 worth of Bitcoin or ETH, and it didn't require you to do anything different in the actual app. It was just sort of all taking place in the background. Like, I think that's basically the only scenario I see right now for how crypto becomes people's daily spending money. Is yeah, Matt and I actually don't know that they're interacting with crypto.
Right. Yeah, Matt and I just started using Google Pay and Apple Pay like last year. So we're we're techno latecomers in a lot of ways. So yeah, actually using some sort of cryptocurrency to buy something, that might be a decade off for me, just based on my previous track record.
Well, I mean, I totally agree with what he's saying as well, because I mean, who's going to pay like 0.00015 whatever, you know, like it's just not in terms that we can recognize. Oh, we can't even get folks to look at price per ounce, you know, like
unit pricing.
When it comes to unit pricing at the grocery store, let alone like, you know, translating in real time a currency from something that feels more esoteric to something that feels a little more tangible, like dollars. But so like on that note, there's actually talk about digital dollars. And I'm sure the DeFi folks out there don't think of that as much of a solution. But like what are your what do you think the prospects are for that? Obviously, you removed that decentralization aspect of it when you have a digital dollar like that. But yeah, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think, you know, we do have digital dollars of a sort now. I mean, you know, most transactions are not cash. They're just entries in a database. But I think what you're talking about is something like a central bank issued cryptocurrency. And I do think that's a little bit of a mirage. Like, I don't know that we're going to have that in the U.S. for quite some time. I mean, our lawmakers are still trying to figure out how Facebook makes money. I think it's going to be a while before there's a robust enough understanding of digital payments in our government to come up with something like that and to put it into widespread use. I also think, I mean, I've talked to a number of privacy activists who are concerned that something like a central bank digital currency could just be a disaster in terms of allowing the government to surveil the movement of money, people's assets, you know, payments they make. It could be a really sort of dystopian thing where the government suddenly knows everyone you're paying and what you're paying them for, and there's no way to sort of conduct transactions that aren't monitored or surveilled in some sort. So I think that's something that may happen in other countries before it happens in the US, but that's not something I'm expecting to happen in the next 5 or 10 years here.
Okay. All right. We have a few more questions for you, Kevin, about cryptocurrency and, you know, some of the problems that it's creating, but then also some of your predictions for the future. We're gonna let you go a little oracle in this next segment. We'll get to that right after this.
Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus 5-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in 5 delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to Kachava.com. kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's kachava.com/howtomoney. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
All right, we're back from the break. We are talking with Kevin Roos, and you know, we talked about cryptocurrencies kind of more as a tool. We talked about the blockchain. Let's talk now about crypto more as like an investment. And one of the criticisms of cryptocurrencies is that it's often been criticized as a Ponzi scheme, and so it's creating some serious problems. Not only that, it's been criticized for its energy consumption. It's been criticized for the scams out there as well that bilk individuals out of their money. Kevin, like how big of a deal do you think are these problems to crypto becoming more widely adopted?
Well, I think there are a couple things here. One, I think these are real problems. I mean, the environmental problem specifically is real. And there are, you know, crypto proponents who will say, oh, you know, the miners are shifting to renewable energy and Ethereum is transitioning to proof of stake. And so there's not going to be this, you know, the energy consumption of crypto is going to fall very soon. But right now it's a disaster, and it's, you know, it's not something that anyone in the industry is particularly proud of. And they attempt to change the subject every time it comes up. So, so I think that's a major issue. The Ponzi scheme of it all, I mean, clearly there are Ponzi schemes and frauds, many of them within crypto. I'm less persuaded by the case that this is all just one giant Ponzi scheme, and that there is nothing of any value being created, and that it's purely a transfer of money from people who are less sophisticated later investors to people who were earlier investors. So that's kind of a non-answer, but I think it's basically yes, we should absolutely be concerned about the number of frauds and Ponzi schemes. I wrote about a couple of months ago, this new scam that is targeting people on dating apps using crypto.
Oh yeah,
that's been just totally rampant.
The romance scams.
Yeah, the romance scams.
And Joel's always had that girlfriend up in Canada. Right. He was just asking him to
don't tell my wife.
Exactly. I mean, I also had a Canadian girlfriend back in the day.
Oh, no way. You too.
But, same one.
But she didn't try to convince me to invest in Dogecoin. So I think we absolutely do need to, you know, keep monitoring this. And as reporters, we need to make sure that we're, that we're reporting on all of it. So, yeah, I think to answer your question, like, big problems. But what's interesting to me, too, is that even with these problems, which are not new, I'm not breaking any news here, people have known about them for years, crypto adoption has risen dramatically. So, you know, something like 30% of millennials in the U.S. own crypto or have owned crypto. And so that's millions and millions of people mm-hmm. who have been convinced to invest in crypto, despite the fact that it's still pretty janky and not the easiest thing to get your arms around. And so I think there's an interesting sort of deeper question here about the set of economic conditions and political conditions that are causing people to sort of take on more risk, that are making them more interested in things like meme stocks or crypto or sports gambling. We have in this country, like a kind of overlapping boom in speculative assets and the decline of real wages and upward economic mobility. So there are a lot of people, including some that I've interviewed, who feel like investing in stuff like crypto and meme stocks and, you know, doing GameStop, day trading is the only way that they're ever going to be able to, say, afford a house.
Yeah.
And that to me is super, super interesting. Not the crypto investing itself, but the kind of economic climate that gives rise to it.
Speaking of the economic climate, like as far as the overlap too, I mean, what are your thoughts regarding the massive amounts of money that flooded the system, right? Because I mean, if we're overlaying graphs, I think we could see a dramatic increase, say, in Robin Hood activity and the amount of money that was
economic stimulus payments
dumped into meme stocks and Bitcoin with the massive amounts of stimmy money that we all received.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some interesting research, I'm sure, coming out of economics departments about what happened to speculative trading activity as the stimulus checks went out. Probably. I suspect that, honestly, like more of it is just that people were home and they were bored and they maybe had a little extra money jingling around in their pocket, but mostly they were just like, I'm bored.
Yeah. Some people literally did have 8 to 10% or more extra money in their accounts because of that, and they weren't able to spend some of the money that they would normally spend at other places coming in. So I think for people who did keep their jobs, there's a bunch of things going on. And you're seeing people just creating just insane returns really quickly overnight, and that gets people interested, right? Like, and so some people were, you saw the headlines of people making millions of dollars in the span of like, you know, a month or two. And so I guess on the flip side of that, though, aren't there a lot of people, especially now, latecomers to crypto, who are just kind of left holding the bag? Yeah, we've got these millions of investors, but aren't almost all of them upside down at this point in their investment?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's the Ponzi side of it. That feels a little bit more like a scam.
I don't think it's
like
intentional, but it's happening, it seems like, to most of the folks who are participating.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think there are, you know, a lot of people who are losing money, especially people who came in late. You know, crypto proponents would tell you, look, you know, everything's down right now. And you have, you know, Netflix is down, what, 40% or something. You know, a lot of the big tech companies are down 20, 30, 40% off their off their all-time highs. So it's not just crypto that is taking a nosedive right now. But I do think, you know, in general, I mean, I think the one thing that is a little bit different in crypto is that there is this kind of religious mentality around holding. So there's this, you know, hodl or whatever you want to call it. Like in crypto, like it is considered a betrayal of sorts to sell. I mean, there's some statistics out there about like how many of the people who invested in Bitcoin or something before, I don't know, 2015 or so, have never sold. And it's a pretty high percentage. And so I think there are a lot of people who got in early and are just, you know, holding on for dear life. And so it's not purely that all the early investors sort of dumped their bags on the schmucks who came later. But that certainly has happened.
I think in a lot of ways we're returning to pre-pandemic times, whether it's the amount of cash that Americans have saved up in their savings account, whether it comes down to the amount of revolving credit we have. I mean, I think there's a lot that we're seeing quickly return. But Kevin, we do want to kind of get your predictions for the future. What do you think the space is going to look like in the future, like 5 years from now? Do you think that we're going to still be talking about Bitcoin as much as we are today? Do you think the term blockchain, like, is that going to sort of be like a daily necessity for most Americans at that point?
No, I don't think that we will all be buying groceries in Bitcoin and putting our assets on the blockchain. I do think that especially in the financial industry, there will be, you know, continued adoption of this stuff in the places where it makes sense. And I don't know that we'll be watching people spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on pictures of monkeys. but I do, like, you know,
digital illustrations.
I'm not the right person to ask on this, because I have been burned before on this. Like, I wrote in 2013, like, Bitcoin is doomed, it's all going away, we're never going to hear about it again, it's going to be, like, you know, consigned to the dustbin of history. And I was, like, wrong about that. Like, it just kept going. And so I'm a little hesitant to say, like, this is all going to stop mattering. I do think there's going to be a lot of projects, coins, NFT collections, whatever, that just go to zero. And the people who promoted them just kind of slink away and go back to their, you know, jobs at Goldman Sachs or whatever. Yeah. But, like, I genuinely do not feel comfortable saying, like, this is all going away.
Right.
Just because, like, I have made that mistake before, and I'm trying to be a little more humble this time around.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, like, you said this multiple times, but it's not really fun being a moderate. It's not fun being somebody who's trying to
reasonable. Like, it's all going to zero, and, like, yeah, we're going back to, you know, we're going back to cash. But, like, I just genuinely feel like money and the way that we think about and use money, like, it has to evolve, right? Mm-hmm. Like, sounds cliche, but, like one moment that was sort of a epiphany for me was looking into kind of the technology that that powers our banking system today, like the technology that all the big banks use today. And it turns out that a lot of it is still written in COBOL, which is this programming language that was invented in the 1960s. Huh. And so a lot of the banking infrastructure that we rely on every day runs on this, like, incredibly rickety old technology, and that's, like, barely hanging together. It's like bubblegum and, you know, and scotch tape level technology. And this powers, I mean, billions of dollars in transactions a day is running on this janky old systems. So I do think that whether it's crypto, whether it's fintech, whether it's whatever, like, I do think that we are going to see more technology improvements in finance rather than fewer. And I think that crypto will have some role there. There will be some form of decentralization that becomes important. But I think there will also just be, like, much more traditional fintech innovation that happens that modernizes the banking system.
Awesome. Hey, Kevin, we really appreciate your insights, man. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Where can our listeners find out more about you and what you're up to?
They can, once I'm technically back from parental leave, they can read me at the New York Times. I'm also on Twitter at Kevin Roos.
Awesome. Well, say hey to Bruce for us when you get off this interview. And
we'll do.
Thanks again for joining us.
He's stuck on a cliff now, but I'll I'll help him off first, and then I'll say hi.
All right. Thanks for having me. Go rescue him. All right. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. That was a very enjoyable, very enlightening conversation we had with Kevin, who, by the way, was definitely not an AI guest. This was a real person who sat down to talk to us. This was not a bot.
That would be awesome if we actually
first
robot on the show. That'd be incredible. No, he's real life human.
So, Joel, what was your big takeaway for this one?
Okay. So lots of good stuff, lots of interesting stuff. I thought in particular, like, future-proofing yourself from some of these possible changes in society and in the way jobs work, jobs function is interesting. Mm-hmm. But I love what he said about crypto and how he mentioned the religious tendencies that it has. And I think it's really hard when you're in the middle of some sort of religious fervor to actually step outside of it and see that there are other emotions and things at work in maybe that are tainting your view of something. And so I think it's a good call.
It's always hard to remove yourself from the cult.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. I mean, it makes me think of, like, truly, Emily and I, we watched the most recent Netflix documentary about fundamentalist Mormon culture in how Warren Jeffs, like, he basically brainwashed people into thinking a certain way. Hmm. And when you're in the middle of it, it's really, really impossible to think that there's some sort of other normal way of life. Everyone else on the outside, they're the crazy people. And I think there's a similar mentality in some parts of crypto culture. And so I think just for our listeners, we want people to be more skeptical. We want people to take a step back and say, all right, is there maybe some truth? Kind of like Kevin, be a moderate and think about maybe some ways that it could impact us for good. But when it comes to betting your life savings or even really putting much of your money, your investable assets into cryptocurrencies, it's something you need to think long and hard about and that you need to allocate at most 5%, but probably there less for most people. Because I think that religious fervor, Matt, it reached fever pitch right earlier this year around the Super Bowl. Yeah. And since then, I think a lot of those people are maybe deconverting from how they thought about crypto. But what was your big takeaway?
I thought all that was great. Mine did have to do with future proofing, which is the name of Kevin's book. But he talked about how we need to step outside of the system, outside of the paradigm of trying to perfectly optimize and to become these efficient machines, essentially. I love the example that he gave of the warehouse workers and how I hadn't read this, but some of the folks who are wearing bracelets that buzz, it makes me think of how we do that to ourselves when it comes to, let's say, something positive that we want to see in our life, right? Whether that's reaching a certain number of steps, there might be a little reminder and it says, hey, make sure, what is it? Like on the Apple Watch, it's like, get your rings or something like that. Like there's all these different mechanisms.
I don't know. I don't abide by those things.
We are not a part of that system. But in the same way, if we are trying to outwork essentially the robots, if we're trying to elbow grease our way into the future, instead what we need to do is be more human and focus on the things that make us who we are, because it's a losing battle essentially if we're trying to outwork the robots, outwork the machines, outwork the software.
Yep.
There's no way that we're going to be able to do that, especially as the digital artistry that these that AI is coming up with sounds incredible, but that is not a game that we want to win at. Instead, we need to focus on the things that allow us to connect with other people, things that make us more social, that make us more human. We should be focusing on those aspects of our jobs, not necessarily becoming a faster, stronger human.
Yeah, I know, I agree. More robot-like, for sure. We want to avoid that and lean into humanity, because that is the way in which we're going to stand apart, stand out. What did he say? Surprising, social, and scarce. Like, those are the elements that you want to develop so that you can succeed in an economy that does rely more and more on artificial intelligence.
Exactly.
But let's get back to the beer, Matt. This one, fittingly, we drank a beer called Analog Life by Good Word Brewing. And I promise, we don't plan it this way, but we see a beer in the fridge and we're like, oh wait, no, actually, that's
in there. And we're kind of like, this one would be, I kind of wanted to mention this one at the beginning, but we forgot.
Yeah.
I felt like Kevin, he would approve of this beer. But yeah, Analog Life, this is an English style mild from Good Word Brewing here out of Georgia. What were your thoughts on this one, bud?
All right, so yeah, I thought it was kind of like a light brown ale in a lot of ways, like a really light brown ale. It was like chill, it was relaxed, I thought it was nicely malted, and I thought it was a good change up from the kind of beers that we often drink.
Zero hop.
Yeah.
Profile.
Yeah, zero hops. And so it's kind of, it really is more like an older German style beer. And
or even English.
Yeah. Or English, I guess. It's a very traditional old world style beer. And
have you ever had Boddington's?
Yeah.
That's an English style.
It's been a long time.
I think
it's
like a blonde English style.
That's right. Yeah.
But very similar, where it feels very drinkable. It's like the OG session. Like session ales or session beers. They're kind of like the English style milds of the IPAs that we have here over in the States. And so in a similar way, very drinkable, very light. This is like a 3.6% beer that you and I split, but also very enjoyable. And plus it's just fun to have a beer with this title on an episode like today. We're talking about technology.
Talking about future stuff and, you know, analog life. There's a lot of that that ain't bad. That's still pretty good, right?
Absolutely.
So, all right, that's going to do it for this episode. For folks who want, links to Kevin's books or some of the writing that he does over at the New York Times, you can find those up on our site at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And we will also make sure to link to that Roomba. I'm seriously going to look up the Wirecutter article that he referenced because Kate and I, we have been talking about, all right, what are some ways that we can automate some things in our life? Because I don't want to have to outsweep. Like, if it comes down to me or whatever I name my Bruce, I want to lose to that robot in this game. That's not a game that
there's
I
a lot of
win.
Things I don't mind robots taking over, and cleaning duties is one of them.
Exactly. But we'll make sure to link to that article. But that is going to be it for this episode. Joel, until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey there, parents and teachers. Are you tired of feeling like every day is a battle of wills with your kids? Let me tell you about something that changed the game. Love and Logic. Love and Logic isn't just another parenting or teaching strategy. It's a mindset shift that empowers you to raise responsible, respectful kids while keeping your sanity intact. With Love and Logic, you'll learn practical techniques to set limits with empathy, give your kids the tools they need to make smart choices, and build relationships based on mutual respect and understanding. Love and Logic stands behind their methods with a 1-year money-back guarantee. Try it out risk-free. If it doesn't change your life, we'll buy it back. Plus, you can get 10% off with code IHEART10. So if you're ready to say goodbye to power struggles and hello to peaceful, loving relationships with your kids, it's time to give Love and Logic a try. Visit their website or call today. Your sanity will thank you. Love and Logic, because parenting and teaching should be a joy, not a chore. Visit loveandlogic.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.